Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. And on behalf of our partners in the Municipal Finance Conference, the Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance at the Brandeis International Business School, the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis, and the Harris Public Policy School at the University of Chicago, I want to welcome you to our annual mid-year webinar. The topic today is quite timely, the effect of COVID-19 on the budgets of state and local governments. We're going to begin with a presentation by Byron Lutz, who's Assistant Director and Chief of the Fiscal Analysis Section of the Federal Reserve Board, who has been working on a paper with my colleague at Brookings, Louise Shaner. I want to warn you, as Byron will, that when Byron uses the word we, he means Louise and Byron, not Byron and Jay Powell, just so there should be no confusion. Byron has a presentation. It'll be about 20 minutes, and then we're very pleased to have a panel that will represent different perspectives on this question. Rachel Eubanks, the treasurer of the state of Michigan, Patrick McCoy, who's director of finance for the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and Gary Hall, who's head of investment banking for infrastructure and public finance at Siebert Williams Shank and Company in New York. So with that, I'm going to turn the screen over to Byron. If you have questions, you can ask them in the Q&A function there on the Zoom. If you have any problem, you can just email me at dwessel@brookings.edu, and we'll try and get as many questions as possible. I'm very pleased to see we have 300 people online to start, which I think is an indication of the timeliness of this event. So Byron, over to you.
Okay, thank you, David. There we go. Okay, so as David already said, this is some joint work with Louise that's ongoing and work in progress. As David also already said, I do need to make it clear, particularly to any members of the press listening, that the opinions I express today are those of myself and Louise and not necessarily that of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. Okay, so in terms of broad motivation, why worry about state and local government budgets? This starts with the fact that these entities almost all have balanced budget requirements. When revenues fall, as they, you know, obviously did at the onset of the pandemic, over some time horizon, there's a need to cut spending or increase taxes. This can be quite negative for the citizens of a state. It can cause, for instance, badly needed public services to fall right at the time when they're most needed. And it would likely be much better to smooth through such shocks, at least at the frequency of the business cycle. It can also be very bad for the macro economy. State and local governments are a big player in the aggregate U.S. economy, accounting for about 13% of total employment. And it's been well documented at this point that the extremely slow recovery in the state and local sector following the Great Recession imposed a material drag on the overall economic recovery in that period. Okay, just to give you a quick sense of what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to start by talking about the revenue performance to date since the pandemic started, and in particular, why revenues have held up better than almost anybody expected in the spring. And then I'll turn to discussing the unprecedented employment cuts that we've seen in the sector and what might explain this. Okay, so here we have a graph that shows pretty clearly the surprising resilience to date of state and local government revenues. I'll start with the red line, which is at the state government level for personal income taxes. We see that the governments were experiencing really robust growth in these revenues prior to the pandemic, but then growth actually, you know, absolutely plunged into, you know, deeply negative territory with the onset of the recession, as well as the decision of most state governments to delay the payment date for final tax year 2019 tax payments from April into July. The payments, income tax payments remained very weak into the early summer, but then bounced back to be about flat and have since grown a little bit to reach about 1.5 or 2% growth by the end of the year. And given the way these estimates are constructed, the final dot here where my cursor is for December, that's the percent growth of total 2020 income tax collections relative to 2019. So what we're seeing here is that for 2020 as a whole, state governments in aggregate, you know, actually experienced a modest increase in their personal income tax collections. The story is fairly similar for sales tax collections. These were, you know, going along fairly strongly. And then with the, you know, really sharp decline in consumption with the onset of the pandemic, you know, growth leveled out to about 0% and has since, you know, edged down a bit to about negative 1% territory. The story is much the same for total state government tax collections in black. And for the year as a whole, they're almost exactly at 0%, meaning total, the current date to date through December, the total collections for 2020 look to be almost identical in nominal terms to 2019. And I should add that this this data comes from the Urban Institute. They have what is by far the most timely and readily available data currently on state and local government tax revenues, and it's quite a resource. This data, the December numbers, just came out yesterday. The final point I wanted to make on this slide is that property taxes, which are by far the largest tax source for local governments, have just plodded on over this year at a very solid 5% pace of growth. Obviously, the housing market over this period has been very robust. And in any case, there's quite a lag typically between when house prices change and when property taxes change. So there's every reason to expect an aggregate for this kind of growth to continue going forward. Okay, the next point I'd like to make is that the revenue losses to date have been notably smaller than in the Great Recession. So the graph on the slide here shows the experience for total real own source state and local government revenues during the Great Recession. What we can see is that the revenues held up at the onset of the recession, and then in late 2008 through 2009 fell quite sharply, ultimately hitting about 8% below their pre-recession level. And then it took a really grueling 5 years for those revenues to recover just to their pre-recession level. The experience in the pandemic is just starkly different. Here in orange, I show the equivalent data for real own source revenues. And what you see is that there was an incredibly sharp one quarter decline in revenue in the second quarter. But then the revenues bounced back in the third quarter and about held their own in the fourth quarter. I should note, however, that this is from the BEA, from the GDP accounts. This data is subject to revision and it could revise downward, but it's hard to imagine it revising so much that it would in any way distort just the stark difference in experience from the Great Recession towards the pandemic. So overall, what the GDP accounts are currently showing is that total state and local revenue in 2020 was only one half of 1% below its 2019 level. Okay, so I'll now turn to the fact that in the spring, most people were many analysts were issuing warnings of simply huge revenue losses. Certainly in the spring, Louise and I were in that camp and were deeply concerned, but the losses have been much smaller than anticipated. In some work that we did with Alan Auerbach and Bill Gale in a recently completed paper, we try to unpack the reasons for this. The first reason is by far the most straightforward. It's simply the downturn was much less severe than most forecasters projected. This is partly due to the simply unprecedented level of fiscal support provided by the federal government. Just to give an example of this, as late as July of 2020, the Congressional Budget Office was projecting that unemployment in the fourth quarter would end at about 10.5%. Well, unemployment actually ended at 6.8%. So the CBO projection, which wasn't that dissimilar from many others, you know, was a full 4 percentage points too high in its projection. And with the economy simply performing better than most expected, tax revenues did the same. The remaining reasons, though, have to do with the fact that this recession has simply been starkly different than most recessions we've had over, say, the past 40 years. Point two hits the point that unemployment in the current experience has been unusually concentrated among lower income individuals, in particular service workers in jobs that require face-to-face contact. And while this is, of course, a huge welfare issue for these lower income individuals, the fact is that because they have lower income, when the unemployment is concentrated in that group, it's simply less of a revenue hit to governments. The third point here is that there was an absolutely unprecedented level of unemployment insurance benefits pushed out the door. And these are taxable in most states, and this helped hold up tax collections. The fourth point here is a bit subtle. Consumption at the household level, you know, had a historic collapse in the second quarter of last year. It fell 33% at an annual rate, which by a wide margin is the sharpest decline we've ever experienced in the post-World War II period. And as a result, you know, sales taxes took a larger hit than most other taxes. However, conditional, given that decline in consumption, sales taxes did not decline as much as you would have expected. And this is because durables consumption has actually held up very well over the last year, whereas there's been an absolute collapse in services spending. But because durables are more prone to be subject to the sales tax than services, sales taxes have held up better than certainly most analysts would have expected. The final fact is very straightforward. Unlike the last two economic cycles where there were large market corrections at the onset of the recession, the stock market has continued to rise. This supports capital gains realizations and also supports income tax revenues, principally at the state level. Okay, so I wanted to provide some examples here of the upward surprises. So the upper table shows what has happened to total own source revenues in the state of California. Pre-pandemic for the current fiscal year, 21, they were expecting about $150 billion in revenue. In May, they were projecting a bloodbath. You know, they thought they were going to be down $30 billion relative to their pre-pandemic projection. But as of late 2020, they had revised back up so that they were expecting no losses at all, and in fact, a small gain for the year, which is really quite remarkable when you think about the expectations in May. Now, California has a very progressive income tax, which situated it pretty well for the current economic environment in a revenue sense. Many states were not, though. Texas is an example. It's very reliant on sales taxes. It also derives a lot of revenue from energy production. And so what you see here is they also, relative to pre-pandemic, had a very large downward revision in their expectations for revenues, but they have not revised up nearly as much. And this has a lot to do with the composition of their tax system. Okay, so the story up until this point has been pretty rosy, but it's been purely focused on comparing what has happened relative to what expectations were once the pandemic hit, and the expectations were truly dire. Of course, if you take a little longer term perspective, things are not nearly as rosy, and there is a large, you know, there's been a large budget hit. We can see this here in this graph. This shows, the blue line shows total state tax collections, the year over year growth. And what we see is that in the 2 years prior to the pandemic hitting, the states were experiencing very solid revenue growth. They had every reason to expect this growth to continue into 2020 and beyond, and they budgeted in that manner. And so even though revenue has been about flat out here for 2020, that was a large decline relative to what their expectations were, and that opened up large budget holes. The second point, which really needs to be emphasized, is there is just immense variation across the states. Here is the 2020% change in total state tax revenues on a state-by-state basis. The pink bar here, which is all but indiscernible, is the sort of flat collections for the nation as a whole. But if we look at the left here, we see that there are five states which have had really intense revenue losses of 10% or more, and six or seven states in excess of 5% declines, but less than 10%. And these are very large declines. The common denominator on these states are they tend to either be energy producing states such as Alaska, North Dakota, and Texas, or their economies are very reliant on tourism such as Hawaii, Nevada, and Florida. But it's also important to note that about half the states either had flat revenue experience or were up, and there are a handful of states which experienced really robust growth, you know, about what you might have expected pre-pandemic. About the only common denominator here is that a number of the states that have done really well were not hit very hard in a relative sense by the pandemic in its early stages in the spring and summer. Okay, the last thing I want to hit is that one thing that these big high-level numbers that Louise and I have put together miss are that there are certain segments of state and local governments that have been absolutely crushed by the current pandemic. One example is any revenue source dependent on transportation has really had a hard time. You know, we're going to hear about this, of course, from Pat, but transit authorities, airport authorities, collections of gas motor fuel revenue have been hard hit. Okay, so I'm now going to shift gears and talk about the expenditure side of state and local government budgets. And here we have a graph that shows on a year-over-year basis the percent change in total state and local government employment. And what we see is that at the onset of the pandemic, right where the gray shading starts here to the right, we see that there was just a precipitous and incredibly sharp decline in employment that's about, you know, has remained at about 6 or 7%. And this decline is absolutely unprecedented in the post-World War II era in terms of its severity over such a short period of time. And this stands in stark contrast to what happened in the Great Recession, where employment continued to rise fairly decently through the first half of the recession, and then growth only slowed gradually and then moved down for many years thereafter and took many, many years to regain its previous peak. So it was certainly a very tough episode from a budget standpoint, but the experiences here in terms of employment are just starkly different. Okay, here Louise and I plot out the percent change on a state basis for total state and local government employment. There's again a fair bit of variation, but I think the real point I'd like you to take away is that the experience is far more uniform than for revenue. You know, every state is either flat or has an outright decline, even though many states saw revenue increases this year. Just as one random example that I happen to be familiar with, if you look here at where my cursor is, the state of Georgia notched a 5% employment decline in 2020, despite the fact that they had a 3% growth in state tax revenue in 2020. Okay, so the next slide simply makes the point that the employment losses have been heavily concentrated in education. The solid lines on the right chart here are for state government employment in the current pandemic. The green line shows what has happened to state education employment. This is largely higher ed. And we see that, you know, this has been hit extremely hard and it's down well over 10%, whereas non-education state employment has only edged down. At the local level to the right, local government employment, education employment, again in green, is down a fair bit, but non-education employment, which also plunged, but it has recovered at least about a third of its initial losses in contrast to what's happened in the education sector. Okay, so I'll now turn to Louise's and I thinking about why we've experienced such large and widespread employment losses. There are three principal reasons that we think explain this. The first is by far the most obvious. It's just the contemporary budget strain. Revenues have come in lower than expected, and there's a lot of heterogeneity in many governments, and some specific types of entities are experiencing strain. and so what we have here on the graph to the left, on the horizontal axis, we have an estimate of how much total own source revenue in a state was predicted to fall, according to the paper Louise and I did. And then on the vertical axis, we have the actual realized percent change in employment and local education. And what you see is a very positive relationship, which suggests that states that, you know, understood they were likely going to be having larger losses did cut employment more. The graph to the right runs the same exercise, but here we're looking at the amount of federal aid they received. This was prior to the December stimulus bill. And here we again see a positive relationship. So states which got more aid per capita also had smaller employment losses. And there's also some nice academic on this point. The current budget strain is definitely having an impact on budgets. That said, I think there's two additional pieces of the story that you really need to have to explain how large and widespread the employment losses have been. The second factor here is simply social distancing or virtual learning. With the onset of virtual learning in many K through 12 schools, as well as higher ed, there's simply been less need or demand for non-instructional staff. So think bus drivers, janitors, cafeteria workers, and so forth. And it's clear that many of these jobs, you know, the employment counts have been brought down there, although it's proven very hard to find systematic information on this. The third factor, I think, is absolutely critically important. It's simply the fact that there is truly extreme uncertainty over future budget conditions. We're experiencing a once in 100-year pandemic. There's really no precedent for this. Moreover, state and local governments had a really scarring experience in the Great Recession and, you know, just about the 10 years that followed. And the interaction of these two facts and the extreme uncertainty has almost certainly made state and local governments just extremely cautious in terms of setting the budgets on their expenditure side. Okay, so in terms of adding it all up, you know, where does this leave us in terms of the condition of state and local budgets? Okay, so the paper we did earlier a couple months ago did a very granular tax by tax estimate of the revenue losses. And here we estimated that the revenue losses over a three-year period would be about $500 billion for the nation and as a whole for all forms of state and local government, including public hospitals and so forth. But again, this was pinned to a CBO projection that is just no longer viable. It's been proven to be way too pessimistic. So Louise and I have done some very rough estimates based on sort of back of the envelope type calculations using the GDP data and pinning it to the current CBO projection for the economic growth over the next couple of years. And here we get revenue losses of between $200 to $300 billion. Now, it's of course important to note that state and local governments have received aid from the federal government at this point with which, including the December stimulus bill, is now up to in the order of $400 billion in aid. None of it is meant to cover general revenue losses, but much of it probably has at least some flexibility to be used to plug budget holes, although there's a variety of opinions on that, to be sure. But the bottom line is the aid to date is in excess of what we would estimate the losses over 3 years will be. But I do want to emphasize that comparing the aggregate national revenue loss to the aggregate stimulus really misses some really important factors. The first is that COVID has generated new expenses, and some of these expenses will continue to be present and create demands going forward, at least the next year, probably beyond that. And it's very unclear how large these expenditures are on a national aggregate basis. Louise and I would be extremely interested to hear any opinions or experiences based on this, because this is a big hole in the story and it's been maddeningly difficult to get a handle on in aggregate. The second is it is uncertain to what extent the stimulus, almost all of which was targeted to certain things such as public health, can be used to alleviate general budget strain. And then final, there's simply lots of variation in the fiscal condition of state and local governments. And with a solid chunk of the distribution facing severe fiscal strain, you know, those governments, you know, you're missing their story when you look at the aggregates. Okay, so I'll just finish up with the question, you know, would more aid to state and local governments increase state and local spending? For Louise and I think the answer is quite clear. The answer is yes, because again, some governments are in fact facing very significant strain. It's also the case that COVID is going to continue to generate new needs for expenditures, and some of these are unknown. For instance, given the reduction in learning that has been well documented at this point during the period of the pandemic, particularly in lower income children, there may be need of years of remedial education. It's also the case that there's a lot of need for some capital investments such as HVAC systems, which obviously can be quite expensive. And then it's also the case that, you know, state and local governments are operating under extreme uncertainty over what's to come. The path of the future economies is critically conditional on the path of the virus, vaccinations, and so forth. And, you know, budget makers don't know how that's going to play out, of course. This is inducing hesitancy, and additional federal funding would provide a buffer that would reduce this uncertainty and likely boost spending. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Byron. There are a couple of narrow questions of fact that have come in, and I just want to ask those before we turn to the panel. One is, when we look at the state employment numbers, if someone is a state employee or a local employee who is furloughed, how does that show up in the numbers? Does that count as someone who's not working?
Yeah, if they are furloughed and not receiving, yeah, here's the employment chart. If they are furloughed and not being paid, they will, you know, show up as a net employment loss.
Okay.
And that is an important.
Go ahead.
No, that's all I was going to say. I mean, the answer is, if you are furloughed and not being paid, and the technical answer is, you know, the BLS who collects these data has a reference week. And if you are not paid in that reference week, you are not counted as employed. So if you're on furlough, not being paid, you will count as a employment loss on the chart I have up currently.
And do you have any data on the differences in who's getting laid off, age, tenure, collective bargaining, so forth?
No, we do not. This is another hole in the story. Louise is smiling because this is something that we have been talking about doing a project on, going on a state-by-state basis and actually collecting some data on this. I would really, for a variety of reasons, like to have such information, but the national data put out by the BLS is not overly conducive to that type of analysis.
And finally, one questioner notes that according to the National Association of State Budget Officers, if you look at spending seems to be up in 2020 and up a little bit in 2021. How do we think about that in relationship to the employment declines? Is it simply that they must be spending and not hiring workers, or what?
That could be part of it. A big part of the story is certainly going to be that a large share of state and local government employment is at the local level. And just by that very fact, a lot of the losses are at the local government level. But it also could be, you know, this is speculation, but for instance, if you're buying public health supplies and stuff, you know, obviously there are portions of the budget outside of compensation, although compensation is by far the largest component of state and local budget. But I think the principal answer is the dichotomy between NASBO focusing on state governments and the focus Louise and I have on the state and local sector as a whole.
I see. Okay. I want to turn to our panel now, and I want to assure people that in the course of the conversation, I'll get to as many questions as possible. Someone asked about, we will be posting the video of this and the slides on our website. Just to turn to our panel, Rachel Eubanks is the treasurer of the state of Michigan. Michigan, the treasurer, has a very broad role. She's the chief financial officer, oversees collection, investment, and disbursement of all state monies, administers the tax laws, and also does the windows. Rachel is appointed by the governor. She was previously on the Public Service Commission, and previously before that spent about a dozen years in the investment banking business on the municipal end of things. Pat McCoy has been at the MTA since 2002 and has been director of finance since 2004. Gary Hall has been in the investment banking business, particularly the public side, for three or four decades. He's currently the chair of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. And although we didn't plan this, it turns out that both the MTA and the state of Michigan are clients of his firms. So I hope you're not billing for this time, Gary.
One quick clarification. I'm the immediate past chair. I've given up the office already.
I thought it was a three-year term from 2018. So I was...
No, don't give me any more.
So we're going to start with Rachel Eubanks, and Rachel has some slides. And Rachel, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the experience has been in Michigan, what you anticipated, and what you actually got. I noticed on Byron's slides that on the revenue side, Michigan was exactly in the middle of all the states. Although on the employment side, it looked like you were on the left end of the chart, more cuts in payroll. So I hope you'll talk about that. But let me turn it over to you and take it away, Rachel.
Absolutely. Thank you, David. And I had a number of opening remarks prepared, but Byron did such a thorough job covering the experience of state and local governments. I'll just say ditto to everything he said. I think we had a pretty average and typical state experience through COVID. And so I'm going to keep these remarks extra brief. But just Michigan's case is, a little bit unique in that we've got a September 30th fiscal year. So we had, of our fiscal 2020 year, we had about 6 months of experience in COVID, which is different than most states, which have June 30th fiscal year. So they had about 3 months of experience with COVID in that fiscal 20 year. So that created a lot more variation in our revenue forecast just because of that, one technical component. But Michigan has a statutorily required revenue estimating process. We meet every January, we meet every May to go through economic indicators and decide on what our projected revenues are going to be for the current fiscal year and the subsequent two fiscal years. We have a meeting of the mind with between the administration and both houses of the legislature. As Byron pointed out, we think about COVID starting in March. We had one experience of having revenues in April, and then May, we were forecasting revenues. And as everyone has pointed out, we revised revenues downwards quite a bit. I mean, in fact, over 2 years, is about $6 billion.
You mean to be advancing your slides, you're not.
Nope, I'm not advancing them yet. Sorry, I didn't, should have explained that this is gonna come later in the story. So thank you, David. So we moved very quickly to adjust our budget. And one of the questions that just kind of came out of this last session was, the relationship between what was happening on the state and local government employment. So Michigan, in response to this giant budget hole that was created from what we anticipate to be a very severe revenue drop off, was we furloughed 100% of our employees 1 day a week. So we utilized from the unemployment insurance program, a work share program that allows employers and the unemployment benefit agency in respective states to work together to provide benefits to those employees who are being furloughed. So it helps to kind of cushion that blow during that period of time where they're laid off. So even though we had employment that was down, I mean, all 44,000 workers down 20% of their work time, they were still basically, their wages were protected, which supported a lot of that spending. But the key part of the story here was the paycheck, was the federal aid. So between the Paycheck Protection Program, the enhanced unemployment benefits, that extra $600 a week, and the federal stimulus checks, about $44 billion in federal aid ended up coming to Michigan. So it became very evident starting last summer that this recession was just not like previous recessions. We couldn't really rely on our typical economic indicators like the unemployment rate, initial jobless claims, GDP, and ISM manufacturing, because those showed very deep recessionary trends, but our revenues were not following suit. And even on top of that, Michigan at one point had a very high unemployment rate. So we had 1 month about 25% of our workforce was unemployed. So when you add on all the additional federal stimulus from the dollars, federal stimulus dollars, that meant, in some cases, a good chunk of that 25% of people were actually making more than they were before they were laid off, which turns out they spent it. And I've got a chart on here that soon. But we've had two revenue conferences since. We had one in January, as well as one last August, and we revised revenues up both times. So as Byron pointed out, we ended up pretty close to where we started. But I'd say the name of the game here was the federal aid. But one thing I just really want to point out here is in Michigan, we are very aware of how this recession is not impacting everybody equally. Women are being impacted particularly hard, as are people of color. And so a lot of our programs have been directed at those individuals trying to get them the aid that they need. So turning to the slides here to demonstrate some of what I was just talking about anecdotally. See if I can get them to advance. Oh, they're not moving, are they?
No.
Am I frozen?
You're not frozen, but your slides are.
Oh, there we go. All right. There we go. Okay. So thinking about the depth of the decline in unemployment that we had.
Rachel, on our screen, we still see the first page.
Oh, you still see the first page. Alrighty.
I think Stephanie has the slide. Stephanie, do you want to, can you share?
I can try.
All right, so why don't you stop sharing, Rachel, and Stephanie will try.
And we had just practiced this before, so for whatever reason, they decided to freeze in between when I was talking.
What's happening?
Are you guys seeing my slides now?
Yeah, can you advance to the next one?
Yep. All right. We good here, Rachel?
Just give me a cue. Yes, we're good. Thank you. Okay. So in 2020, you can see this large employment decline that we had in Michigan. So when you even compare that on a relative basis to our worst year in the Great Recession, which was 2009, I mean, it just absolutely eclipses the amount of employment loss that we saw. I included in here the projections for 21, 22, and 23. So as we're looking forward into our forward-looking budget impacts, thinking about what that's going to mean for us in terms of revenues. So even we had this very sharp decline in employment and a lot of economic indicators, but it's going to be a slower and modest recovery as we come back. Stephanie, you can go ahead. All right, thank you. All right, so talking about the amount of tax revenue we had coming in from unemployment benefits. So we've got a chart here going back to 2005, including the Great Recession, where you can see that we had, you know, unemployment benefits that really never exceeded about $134 million a year. But by in 2020, we had $557 million in withholding coming in from unemployment benefits. So individuals that were not working, you know, we had basically the Unemployment Insurance Agency in Michigan was the state's biggest employer at one point. So that was a big chunk of the tax revenue that we had coming in. And Stephanie, next slide. And just kind of trying to draw home here the difference between, you know, what we were seeing from an economic standpoint and what was happening on the tax revenue front. So the green line is our withholding amount, and the blue line is the amount of wages and salaries that we have in Michigan. And normally those lines track pretty closely together, and that makes sense, right? If you're working, if you're earning a paycheck, you're having those, your amount of income taxes withheld, and that should kind of go together, that should move together. But you see this really big divergence happening in 2020. So we have this huge decline in wage and salary income, but this big increase in withholding. So, and a lot of that has to do with that unemployment insurance piece coming in. But, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of other things happening in these numbers, which we're going to be kind of working on over time. But a big piece of that has been the unemployment benefit side. Stephanie? Now, talking about, you know, what are people, how are people spending their money? So we talked a little bit about, you know, that they're shifting from services to durable goods. But the question is who's spending their money? So this data comes from JP Morgan Chase, and they collect data on all of their customers' accounts, whether it's a credit card account or a checking account. And then they can tell when those customers have received unemployment benefits. So they can compare the ones that have received them versus the ones that have not. And so the ones that received the benefits are in the yellow line, and the ones that did not are in the blue line. And this graph tracks their spending compared to, you know, the previous year. So what you see is coming up on the pandemic, you know, I mean, everyone's got their normal spending trends. The individuals that got laid off in the yellow, you see this very dramatic decrease in spending. And then a couple of weeks in, when the federal aid package comes in and they start receiving unemployment benefits, you see this big spike in spending. It doesn't go back up to where they were pre-pandemic. It far exceeds where they were pre-pandemic. So individuals got their unemployment benefits and then they spent them. Compared to those in the blue group who maintain employment, who had that severe drop in their spending heading into the pandemic, and it still hasn't really recovered from that. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, a lot of the services that people normally spend on. You know, if they're not going out to eat, they're not traveling, they're saving their money, and they have not returned to that additional level of spending. And I think I've got one more slide. Okay, great. So online shopping here in Michigan has been a huge part of our what supported our sales tax revenue. So in normal years, you know, we see kind of an average kind of fluctuating around 10 to, you know, 30 million or so. But then in the pandemic, you see this huge increase in the amount of online shopping that has happened. So It's increased about $300 million in online shopping versus what it was in the previous year. So a lot of, you know, you're seeing people substituting their spending from kind of bricks and mortar stores to online shopping, in addition to shifting from services to durable goods. So that's it for my slides, Stephanie, if you want to stop sharing. I just had one last point on this, which is the quality of the data. Economists who go out and collect this data do a tremendous job. And I think as economists, you know, we all take that for granted sometimes, that that's, you know, it's a given, they can do that. There's data like the unemployment rate, which really require a lot of, you know, individual contacts to get that information. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're questioning is, because of the conditions of the pandemic, has it created challenges for the individuals that produce, you know, our typical economic indicators that we have not yet figured out? So, you know, I think there's some pieces of a revenue picture compared to their economic picture that we can, you know, easily explain. I think there's still some noise there. And I think probably as we go forward, you know, we'll be seeing, you know, perhaps some revisions to that data that can help fully explain the story.
Rachel, let me just ask you one specific question that came in. The JP Morgan data you showed on spending, is that national or Michigan specific?
That's national data.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Pat, the job I'm glad I don't have is your job, being director of the New York City Public Transit System. So how bad is it?
Yeah. Thanks, David. And I want to thank everybody for joining us here today. I'll just put up a couple slides here to kind of illustrate and respond to that question. Let me just grab that file. Okay. Hopefully you can see this operating impacts of the coronavirus pandemic. I'm going to come to a chart here in a second, but I just wanted to, you know, kind of set the table. The impacts of this pandemic are stark and more severe than anything we've ever dealt with here at the MTA. You know, for those who are not familiar with the MTA, we provide public transportation services in the New York region, which obviously includes the city of New York, the five boroughs of the city, but also the seven surrounding counties, which has a population of about 15 million people. And pre-COVID, our daily ridership occasionally hit about 8.5 million people per day. So, you know, really, we are the essential mobility provider in this region. And of course, as soon as the pandemic hit and the lockdowns started, we saw a dramatic, precipitous drop off in ridership of approximately 95% compared to the prior year. For, you know, our bridge and tunnel facility, which is the largest bridge and tunnel facility in the country, with nine toll facilities in Tri-City, we saw traffic down by 64.4% for the month of April, which was the worst month we have seen. Early on in the pandemic, we engaged with McKinsey to help us understand what the impacts were going to be. And in May, they had estimated approximately $10.3 billion revenue loss for the two-year period beginning in 2020. So it was very significant. In addition to the just, you know, the hit on our ridership, the MTA does rely on a variety of dedicated taxes to support operations, including, you know, sales tax, payroll mobility tax, a variety of petroleum business taxes. While those have not been hit as dramatically as ridership, you can see here that the estimates were $281 million in our July financial plan and an additional $116 million for 2021 in our November plan. State dedicated tax receipts through the end of the year were about 11.5% lower compared to the same time frame in 2019. And about 18.7% lower compared to the 2020 adopted budget. Also, our real estate tax receipts were also lagging significantly more, 25.7% compared to the prior year and 23.3% lower than the adopted budget. But the real story here is ridership, because that is our essential mission. So if I just go to this next slide, this really tells the story of 2020. And I'll focus first on the green line, and that is our bridge and tunnel traffic across our toll facilities. And that's been our best performing segment of our operations, principally because people still feel comfortable in their cars. And that certainly makes sense in a pandemic. Beneath that, the orange line is our bus ridership. And a lot of folks were taking the buses. And there was a period where we didn't allow front door boarding. We allowed only rear door boarding. And so we didn't have rear door fare collection technology. So we were effectively, while we didn't suspend the fare, it was hard to collect it. And so you can see here that ridership was going up. As of August 31st, we allowed front door boarding. We insisted people pay their fares, and we saw a slight drop off in ridership because of that. The big story, obviously, is subways, the blue line, and then Long Island Railroad and Metro North Railroad, which are the gray and the gold lines, respectively. And as you can see, even at the end of the year, we were still down approximately, you know, in the 60 to 70% range, depending on the day, for those systems. And that continues. While we're seeing, you know, some return to public transportation, this has just been had a dramatic impact on our budgeting and our ability to forecast what we're going to do going forward. So with that, I think that tells the story. We're continuing to provide our services in spite of all this. And we made a commitment early on in this pandemic to ensure that essential workers could get to and from their jobs and provide those services that we all rely on. And so we sort of had the double-edged sword problem, which is that, you know, while we wanted to reduce costs and during the pandemic, it was hard to do that and still provide our critical mission services for the region. And that's really the story here. We have benefited significantly from the CARES Act that delivered $4 billion. We spent that money pretty much by the end of July, and we've anticipated an additional $4 billion from the new stimulus. We're still waiting for the final results and the final numbers to come out on that, but we're estimating about $4 billion, which will be significant for this year. Notable activities in 2020, though, to help us get through the pandemic, we were an active participant in the Municipal Liquidity Facility, which we issued a $2.9 billion note into that facility using a new credit, the Payroll Mobility Tax Credit. So we were very pleased to have that available to us. I think that the story of the MLF is well understood as it should be. The fact that this facility was created had an enormous favorable psychological impact on our market. Ensuring that state and local issuers had a buyer of last resort, so to speak. And while the program is closed, I can't underscore enough the importance of that facility and enable us to position ourselves to use it and then get through the year intact. We're obviously continuing to keep our sleeves rolled up and tackling the problems going forward in this year. So with that, why don't I stop and look forward to any commentary or questions.
If people have the Municipal Liquidity Facility was set up by the Federal Reserve.
Correct.
To lend money to state and local governments or entities like the MTA. It was not widely used. The MTA was one of very few borrowers. But as Pat points out, it made possible, apparently, and Gary can talk about this as well, lots of people to access a market that might not otherwise have been open. So, Gary, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the world has looked from the point of view of the municipal capital markets.
Well, the probably the biggest evidence on how I look, I had less gray at the start of the year than I do now. We saw an unprecedented liquidity crisis in the municipal market. You know, we had MMD drop 50 basis points a day early on. And a metric that we use to measure the health of our market is the percent of the ratios of municipals to treasuries. That typically is around 90% of 10-year treasuries. We saw that go to 300 to 800% in April and May. And today, fortunately, we're down to at historic lows at 60%. So the market is definitely stabilized as of late. Right now, we're in a sort of a nirvana standpoint where we've had a consistent inflows with cash coming into mutual funds, those investors that will go out and buy municipal bonds. In fact, we had 13 weeks of consecutive inflows coming into positive inflows coming into these funds. So there's a tremendous amount of cash looking for investment opportunities. I will tell you that the spreads on lower rated credits are tighter than we ever seen. And I'll give you two examples of that. Two deals that we're involved in was a deal for the Chicago Public Schools. You may recall that they were going through some tough bargaining negotiations and actually announced a strike. We are part of a transaction that was about $558 million during the course of the announced strike. And to our surprise, that deal yielded long-term spreads of historic proportions. Typically, in past years, you might get 500 to 480 bips off the our benchmark, which is MMD on the long end. This deal resulted in 105. So significant improvement for that transaction. The same can be said for a deal that we did for Detroit Public Schools more recently, where that had that's been a story credit. Once was in bankruptcy. And we had a deal that was 20 times oversubscribed and yielded an ROTC lower than 3.4%. So the beneficiary of our strength of our market has been some of the lower rated credits. As we go forward, one of the things that we're noticing, the price discovery that's required to getting deals is more artful, more engagement in discussing the credit metrics with investors, both on the objective metrics and subjective metrics. On the subjective portion, things like vaccination distribution procedures and the ability to make tough decisions should there be a decline in revenues. You know, making sure that you have a handle on those fixed costs, whether it be pension costs or making sure you have access to restructuring in the market. These are the sort of things investors are asking our issuers to really expound upon. And it's requiring our issuers to spend more time one-on-one investors to get them comfortable. After we saw decline in 2008, 2009, a bond insurance in our market, a lot of our investors have stepped up their credit analysis. And so we're seeing that issuers are being evaluated differently based on different metrics that different investors are applying. So we're spending a lot of time with our issuers, helping them sort of explain their credit stories. The thing that we still don't know, and I know Byron spoke to this a little bit, is what the picture and the long-term implications of COVID crisis is on the fiscal crisis, stability of our state and local governments. You know, we historically have annual reports that are a little dated. And so things like unrestricted fund balances, where we can actually see the percent of annual revenues and fund balances to get a picture of the flexibility to meet revenue shortages, is something that's going to be very, very important. The days in cash on hand, once these are formalized and investors can see the health of certain state and local governments, that's going to really cause credit differentiation in our marketplace going forward. And then lastly, still the unknown is what benefit the state and local governments receive from any sort of federal stimulus package. And particularly, are any restrictions will be on any funding they receive from the federal government. So these are the things that we are yet to know, but where I was before in early March to where I am now is sort of light years.
Thank you. There are a couple of questions from the audience. I'm gonna pose some of them and then we're gonna let Louise ask. Gary, I think this is a simple question. One questioner asked why the municipal liquidity facility was not used by more state and local governments.
So, I would say I think the aim of that was to give the market a little bit more stability. And so it was the borrower, lender of last resort, as opposed to being sort of the repository of cash for state and local governments. And so what we found is having that resource out in the marketplace, and Pat can speak to this, actually allow for a more efficient access to the capital markets because that existed, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were able to arbitrage, if you will, that benefit with what we can get in the public markets. And that stability was extremely helpful at the time.
So basically the terms just weren't attractive to many borrowers because they could do better in the commercial market. Rachel, a couple of people have asked about infrastructure spending at a time like this. After all, as Gary pointed out, even the Chicago public schools and the Detroit public schools can borrow at relatively low rates. So are you spending more on infrastructure given that what borrowing rates are? What are the constraints on that?
So infrastructure borrowing is a great question. My the governor that I work for, Governor Whitmer, actually I'm appointed at state treasurer. So she ran on a platform in 2018 of fixing the damn roads. That's actually was the campaign slogan. You can watch some YouTube videos on it. And she initially tried to get a gas tax increase in place to do that. She was unsuccessful working with the legislature to get that done. So then we moved forward with getting a, you know, moving forward with a bonding package. So the state's planning to do, our Department of Transportation is going to do somewhere between $2 and $3 billion of bonding to access capital and get some of those road projects going. Because as, you know, the condition of the roads continues to decline, it can hit this like exponential point of decline where it becomes, you know, many times more expensive to fix it. So which is why we're moving forward with that. But certainly, you know, when I went and made the case for this in front of our legislature, I pointed to these historically low interest rates. You know, if you can do this and spread these costs over some time and not be penalized too much from an interest perspective, I think it is a good time to be bonding for those projects if you don't have the tax dollars to support them.
And you need a vote of, do you need the voters or just the legislators in?
So this is a great question. So the in Michigan, the Michigan Department of Transportation has constitutionally dedicated revenues that come from our mostly from our state gas tax revenues, as well as some registration and other fees. So those are constitutionally dedicated to those funds. They provide strong debt service coverage, so they're revenue bonds, not, you know, a general obligation bond, which would be, you know, required by the voters.
Gary?
Yeah, David, one of the things that we are also seeing when we think about new money spending for capital improvements, while as Rachel mentioned, the cost of borrowing is exceedingly attractive. One of the things that a lot of our issuers are struggling with is the exponential rise in the cost of construction. Obviously, with the COVID crisis and navigating the health concerns, that's caught added costs. Additionally, we still have vestiges of the trade wars for raw materials. And that, too, is having an impact on the value or the pricing, the price of contracts they're getting for new money. So that's one of the things we're following very, very closely.
Pat? Obviously, a lot of us are wondering, we were actually talking about this just before the program began, whether people are going to go back to the office. So when you think in the long run about the MTA ridership, how do you think about teleworking, people moving out of the city, more online shopping, fewer people on Fifth Avenue?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question, David. And it's one that we're grappling with. We don't have any firm answers on it. But I would follow up with my comment on the McKinsey analysis that, you know, we used their work to estimate our ridership in our July financial plan. We actually revisited the work that they did. And for our November plan, they came up with actually a more pessimistic return to public transportation. And it is our assumption that at this point that we don't get close to pre-pandemic ridership till early in 2025 at this point. And we think that's both the dynamic that you alluded to of, you know, people are, there's a new normal now. People are working at home, they're used to it. Companies are recognizing that productivity remains strong, whether people are in the office or at home. And those kind of dynamics are gonna continue to stay with us long after the pandemic. And I think that's going to affect the MTA in terms of overall ridership. What we do with the fare structure is going to be part of that mix, clearly, because we do rely heavily on the fares, you know, in our budget. But if I could, I did want to also kind of revisit the prior topic of infrastructure spending. You know, prior to the onset of COVID in the fall of 2019, the MTA board moved forward with the largest five-year capital program in our history, a $51 billion five-year capital program. And unfortunately, because of COVID, we've largely put those projects on pause. We haven't revised the program at this point. We're just trying to see what we can move forward with what funds are available now, principally federal dollars. That said, our infrastructure spending in 2020 We invested $4.1 billion in capital investments in 2020. So during the pandemic, there are so many projects going on at any given time that to just stop all that would not have made sense. So we've continued, particularly those critical projects that are essential for safety and overall service levels. So I think going forward, that's going to be a question that we continue to grapple with. I think there'll be more to say on that as the year rolls out and we have better information.
So someone asked, can you say a little more about the pessimism in the McKinsey Transit projection? Is it just that people won't be coming to the work that often as they were before, or they'll be afraid to take public transit?
Yeah, you know, there's actually, I'll put a slide up. If you just bear with me here a second, I'll find this slide because I do want to. Okay, here we go. So let me just share this screen. So I'm going to put this slide up, and this is really speaks to what I just spoke about. You see the green line, which by the fourth quarter of 2024. We're really back to normal. And that was our what we called our July plan midpoint. And we asked McKinsey to provide two scenarios, a low scenario and a high scenario. We chose the midpoint of those back in July. When we revisited the analysis, some of those dynamics came into play. For example, the new normal, people choosing to work from home more, companies downsizing office space and having more workers work remotely. And so what you see here, the red line on the bottom is our November plan worst case. We decided to pivot from the midpoint of the McKinsey analysis to the worst case. Quite frankly, things can always be better, but we really don't want more downside surprises. And because of the uncertainty of what happens, we chose that scenario. So the lighter pink scenario was their best case, and we built our financial plan around the worst case for that reason, because of the uncertainty.
Thanks, Louise. I want to ask you a question and then let you pose some. So one of the people on the webinar asks, so what's a reasonable amount of money for the federal government to give in the next COVID bill? $100 billion, $200 billion? What's how do we think about this?
So it's a really hard question to answer because, as Byron mentioned, our big missing piece is on the spending side. Well, there's really two things. One, it's on the spending side. So we really don't have a good handle, not only on what state and local governments have spent, but the right question is what should they spend, right? So we have kids who have not had schooling, right? What should they be spending to get those kids to make up for the lost education? Anything that they can do that, it will be worth it. They should do it. With their balanced budget requirements, you need to give them the money if you want them to do that. Otherwise, it's probably not going to happen. So you can't just look at what they're spending. You really want to say, what do they need to spend? Another question I have, and I don't know if Rachel can speak to any of this stuff. Part of what's gone on, I think, in the spending is things have been kind of closed. The MVA is operating at 1/3 capacity in Virginia. How much makeup spending is going to happen and have to happen when the pandemic occurs? So maybe what they've had is like they've been able to spend on COVID because they've been saving on some of their, bus drivers. But like how much extra spending is there going to be next year? And so I think that's just really hard to tell. And then again, if you read through what they're writing about, there's this tremendous caution out there, right? So I was going to ask Rachel this question. So I look at Michigan, you say, okay, so you thought revenues were going to be kind of bad. And so you did this furlough. You got a huge amount of aid in the CARES Act last spring. So you knew it was coming. Then your revenues start coming in. Like, what happened? Did you quickly reverse the furlough? Did you say, oh, well, we don't know what's going to happen, so let's save that money? How does like that process look at it? So what we want is to make sure that state and local governments do the spending they should do, both because of the macro economy and because of the needs that of taxpayers that are not being met. So you might be able to say, oh, they should be able to spend this money with what we give them. But if they're not doing it, then we should give them enough so they know that they can count on it and that they do the spending. That's the goal. And I just think, like, Byron and we really, really want to understand the spending side better, because how do you answer this question without it? And I'm going to add one more thing, which is, and if you think about it, there's obviously going to be a lot of uncertainty, especially because I'm saying how much should you spend, and nobody knows how much it's going to cost to get these kids up, right? And back up, and there's probably other things, but the kids to me like really looms large. So should you just do what you think is going to be enough, or should you be quite generous so that you make sure that you do get the outcome that you want, especially with, you know, not really interest rates so low. I'm not really worried about the federal debt. Like, erring on the side of doing too much is something I would do. But so I'm going to pass it on to Rachel to kind of see, like, the mystery that we put up about the payroll and whether or not you could sort of like bring that home to Michigan and explain it.
So Rachel, did you get the question?
So there's two pieces in here I wanted to address. First was what I call like potential energy in the economy related to what people have not been spending. So you're absolutely right. You know, we are seeing this increase in incomes. And we're also seeing this huge, and that's a modest increase on the income side, but we're seeing this huge increase in the savings rate. And what's happening is you've got people on the upper end of the income spectrum who are not doing their normal activities. They're not traveling or going out to eat or whatever. And they're instead saving that money, and they're very eager to spend it. So I think we'll get into the next year, and I think some of that will be freed up and releasing that potential energy. But a key point here is really the decisions by public actors. I think what we found more than not is that, you know, individuals are making their own decisions about what they want to do and what they don't feel comfortable doing in this environment. So, I mean, while maybe government actions do have some impact, I think the greater, far greater piece of that is the decisions made by the private consumer. The second piece that you touched on is about, you know, like revenues aren't as bad. Well, they're not as bad because we got all this federal aid. If you go back to the economic fundamentals of even where we are today versus what's happening in revenues, it's a complete mismatch. And the revenues are where they are today because of the federal aid. And as we go through the year, did we ease up on furloughs right away? No, because we knew that unemployment package was going to run out and that individuals were going to come up on the end of that. The Paycheck Protection Program is going to end, that there was no additional federal stimulus checks that were incoming. And so we did not have any basis to increase those revenues because, again, we revert back to the economic fundamentals. And that's what happens. So as the federal government aid comes in kind of piecemeals, and don't get me wrong, we are grateful to have it, but it becomes very difficult to budget for the long term because of the uncertainty on how much and when are we going to receive those.
Louise, do you want to pose some more questions or shall
I? I want to follow up on that. So like one of the questions we are going to be asking about this whole episode is what did we learn and what should we do next time and how to think about it. And so what economists have been talking about recently is we need to have triggers. We need to have plans written in that says when the unemployment rate goes up to X, the federal government will give state and local governments aid. It will increase the Medicaid. So is one of the lessons that if you had known when you did your budget, what the unemployment benefits were going to be, what the CARES Act was going to provide, you actually wouldn't have done the furloughs that you did?
I mean, I think what you're saying is if we could have seen the future and known that the revenue impact wasn't going to be severe, I mean, would we have not laid off employees? I mean, of course. I mean, state employees provide critical services to the people of Michigan. And, you know, to the extent that they're not working a day a week, that's a phone that's not being answered. That's a, you know, child welfare case that's not being attended to. That's, you know, a public safety issue that's not being attended to because we're down on those capacities. So, you know, whenever we can, we do try to preserve state workforce. But in the face of a $3 billion shortfall in 6 months, we did what we had to do at the time.
Gary, one of the questioners asked, and Louise and Byron might want to take on this, is what is happening to funding for state and local pensions now? And what will be the long-term impact of this episode on those?
Before I answer that, I would be remiss if I didn't say the exchange that just took place between Louise and Rachel is the exact same exchanges that are take place between investors and issuers all over the country, right? And so no longer are investors making their binding pricing decisions just based off ratings. They're kicking the tires. They're asking these sort of questions that Louise are asking Rachel. And so fortunately, Rachel was able to do that, Pat, as well. But that's something we spend a lot of time with our issuers on. With respect to pensions, you know, you've got the double-edged score. You obviously, you've got the whole issue of the performance of the pension systems, and we've had a pretty strong equity markets for the last 3 or 4 years, and that's been helpful. But as I mentioned before, these are fixed costs. These annual contributions that occur are fixed costs, and places like the state of Illinois, the state of New Jersey, the city of Chicago really have some real swallowing of elephants in order to navigate these things. And so investors are spending a lot of time, and issuers are becoming very creative. We've seen a return of pension obligation bonds being issued all over the country. That's when an issuer go out and issue a debt at a certain cost with the bet that they'll be able to earn interest higher than the debt that they are repaying and be able to arbitrage that difference of that to be able to close their unfunded liability gap. And what's particularly acute about that is that these have been done in very small counties and school districts. So not just your large issuers are doing it, in places that you would not think that have the sophistication on knowing exactly how they're going to meet their investment return and making sure that bet is actualized, are making these sort of decisions to go out and address these fixed costs. So the puck is still unknown and where it's going, but it's something that both investors and rating agencies are spending a lot of time scrutinizing our issuer base for.
And on these pension obligation bonds, so one advantage, or I should, one feature is that then the local government has to make the payments. You can't put them off. So it's a way of turning what's essentially implicit debt into explicit debt.
Yeah, you turn a soft cost into a fixed one. The other thing that's helping is that we've seen a sizable uptick in the volume of taxable municipal bonds. And so typically that was around $20 billion. It's now roughly $150 billion. So being able to educate a wider investor base is swinging pricing leverage to the benefit of the issuer. And so they get an access to this taxable investor base that they haven't had before.
Louise and Byron, do you want to weigh in on pensions?
You're on mute.
They don't, I will.
Louise, do you want to go ahead or?
Okay. I mean, you can go ahead, Byron, if you...
I would just, you know, I think one of the obvious additional things, I would add one of the very straightforward additional things with pensions is there's been a sharp fall in interest rates since the onset of the pandemic. And, you know, to the extent that that ultimately feeds through to the return on their total portfolio of assets, that has implications.
So just to preview, Louise and Byron have a big paper on state and local pensions, which will be presented the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity on March 24th. They have lots to say about that. But Rachel, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on the pension question.
I was just going to finish the other side of the equation that Gary started on, right? So we've got this low cost of capital on the borrowing side, even on the taxable basis, which is, you know, I think driving a lot of that decision, but you still have to invest it and earn that return. And you're doing that at a time when you've got, you know, equity prices at all time highs. And so, I mean, you've got to make sure kind of both sides of that equation work so that you can make that bogey. But I was going to, you know, defend the local governments a little bit that are making these decisions because, I mean, it's something obviously that's floated around all the time at the issuer level. It's not something the state of Michigan has done. It's something not something that, given the circumstances, I would advise that we do. However, you know, most of these communities have very limited levers where they can pull and make this dramatic of a financial difference in their whole financial picture. So if you're hit with something like a pandemic that hit us so quickly and their revenues are getting hit so quickly and they don't have a chance to adjust their on their expenditure side, they're not left with a lot of levers that they can use that's going to make that big of a difference in the way that pension funds do.
I mean, I think that one of our arguments would be that that's actually quite appropriate, right? That, you know, that these very, very tight budget rules aren't really helpful during a pandemic. And if you have some leeway, that's a great thing. Can I ask Rachel, I think the question that no one's really answered and that everybody wants to know, do you have a sense of sort of what the extra expenditures are because of COVID? How big, how much of the federal aid has gone really just to those things?
You know, so that comes on the budget side of our house. I'm, you know, on the revenue, more on the revenue side, but I think it's something that, I mean, obviously there's a substantial amount of reporting that goes along with the receipt of these federal dollars. So I'm assuming that there'll be reports on this here soon.
I know it's early for Christmas presents, but may I make a early request of Byron and Louise? You know, as you're studying the pension sort of situation in our country, having a feel for what the IRRs for the different pension rates would be exceedingly helpful. We see a lot of variance as to the expected rate of return that a lot of pension systems sort of pledge themselves towards, and that factors greatly into how they calculate their unfunded liability. So having some sense of what's out there and what that range looks like would be extremely illuminating.
Pat, do you have a pension issue at the MTA? How does that work?
So sure. And you know, I'm glad you asked, because, you know, I think New York has taken kind of a long-term view of the pension challenge, you know, with a substantial state workforce and you know, including authorities like the MTA that are part of it. Going back probably 15 years, the state began introducing new tiers with less favorable benefit packages for new employees. So I think the there's a long-term view that over time you're going to get there, shifting more towards, you know, away from the defined benefit programs into defined contribution programs, and giving employees, you know, sort of a optionality there to choose. And a lot of new employees are choosing to have more control over their retirement benefits and opt for the defined contribution with the match, which is a more manageable sort of product, you know, for state and local. So,
and separately, what's happened to employment in the MTA? Have you laid off a lot of people or not?
So we have not. We have implemented a hiring freeze early on in the pandemic, just due to attrition alone, our 70,000 workforce is lighter by about 3,000 just through attrition. Now, keep in mind, prior to the onset of COVID, you know, the state of New York passed a law requiring us to undertake a major transformation of the agency. And that has been slightly delayed, although I would say that work is continuing on that transformation. And over the next year or two, you'll see significant efforts implemented to realize kind of this vision of the legislature to have the MTA be more efficient, leaner. We're going after those obvious elements in the budget, like overtime, consultant contracts, non-personnel costs, and cutting wherever we can. Our budget has had an assumption of, our December budget has an assumption that over the financial plan horizon through 2024, we're going to take out an additional $2 billion in recurring costs. And that's aside from the transformation itself, which is in itself a separate initiative.
Louise and Rachel, there are a couple questions about Medicaid. One is, how has Medicaid impacted state Medicaid budgets and forecasting new enrollees and stuff? And then Rachel, you got a big increase, I believe, in FMAP, the federal contribution to Medicaid, and how important was that? So Louise or Byron, do you have any idea on the Medicaid question?
Yeah, so when we were trying to calculate how much aid the federal government has given state localities, what we did is look at the change in the FMAP, right? So that's the share of Medicaid spending that the federal government pays. It's typically, depending on which group, with the ACA expansion, but 60-40, depending on lower income states, it's higher, and higher income states, it's lower. And they boosted at 6.3, I think, percentage points, I can't remember exactly, for the duration of the public health emergency without stating exactly what that was. But, you know, for at least a year or probably two. And so we calculated that the increased cost that Medicaid was going to be having, because as people lose their job, they're more likely to be eligible for Medicaid. So Medicaid costs go up, but we estimated the Medicaid share paid by the government was big enough that was actually an extra source of funding to the states, right? So their costs go up, but not as much as the federal part went up. And so it kind of freed up some money. And that was part of the aid that we calculated, was that excess Medicaid. And I don't know what the Michigan experience has been like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, on the budget side, but I will say, I mean, you know, I do have awareness that we did increase, did receive an increased amount of those FMAP funds. And it was, you know, kind of part of that budget solution. But I will go say again and reiterate, just for 1 year, you know, I mean, we continue to have, you know, this lengthy period of time where we've got all this uncertainty. And, you know, until we can really look at things on the kind of a multi-year basis, it becomes very difficult to budget for, you know, kind of long-term ongoing programs versus just one time.
Can I ask Gary, when just beyond just Michigan, but when states do these kinds of budgets and these economic forecasts, do they tend to be very cautious economic forecasts? Whose do they use? Do they use CBOs? Do they use, I mean, how do they, what does that look like?
Well, the efficacy of these revenue forecasts are coming up more scrutinized now, as you might imagine, by investors, and it ranges. There is no one cookie cutter approach. In California, it's very regimented with a lot of stakeholders and watchdog groups are involved in the process. Other places, that it's not. So no harmonized way of looking at it. And so it requires some real deep diving in it. And there's a tremendous amount of subjectivity in it, unfortunately.
Let's see. Gary, do you think that they ought to restart the municipal liquidity facility? And if so, how would you do it?
You know, again, I mean, the benefit, the true benefit of that is for market stabilization and confidence. And now when Treasury is our 10-year Treasury is our 1.34 and 30-year are 1.95, you know, our market is pretty strong today. So right now, I would say that we're fine, and I was okay with the expiration of it. I know others might have counter views. Now, again, there's a delayed sort of memorialization of the real sort of health, financial health and fiscal health of our state and local governments, because our annual reports are typically, take a while to get memorialized. We'll know a little bit better what the state of play is. And obviously, if there's any sort of hiccups with the vaccination and a prolonged pandemic, that's going to cause more strain and require the Federal Reserve to step up more. So the jury's still out.
I started to answer one of these questions myself, but maybe I couldn't. Someone said, Byron says the state revenues have held up pretty well. Despite the uncertainty, it seems states should be okay without new federal assistance. Why do speakers seem so intent on getting new aid to states? And it seems to me, Louise, correct me if I'm wrong, you made this case. One, we know a lot about revenues. We don't know how much their spending has gone up or how their spending should go up. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we know if state and local governments overreact and cut employment or cut spending, that has huge macroeconomic negatives, as it did during the Great Recession. We have lots of evidence of that. And third, it's insurance. It's insurance against what Gary just said. The vaccine doesn't work. People don't take it at a time when the federal government, although it's borrowed a lot of money, is borrowing at very low rates. So I think that's the case.
I'll add one more to that, which is there's a lot of heterogeneity, as Byron mentioned, both right. across states and within states. And, you know, across states, this is a political process. You're not going to just give money to certain states. And so you sort of like, if you want to hit the ones who really need it, sometimes everybody has to get some. Second, you know, you might think, well, within a state, they should just redistribute money right away from like, well, this pot is doing well and that pot is doing badly. Let's just, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all one family. That may not be happening. And so you might say the only way to make sure that every need is met is by like having sort of a little bit, you know, more money in the system to make sure. And I think that's really important.
And David, I would add this, you know, in addition to obviously as much money as they can get out of the stimulus package. The other thing that state and local governments are craving for is this opportunity to restructure, refinance tax-exempt debt with tax-exempt issuance. When the Trump administration took that away, that was a huge lever that state and local governments use in order to extract savings from the marketplace by doing refinancing. Said differently, we want folks refinancing their mortgages when rates are low. We want the same sort of opportunity for state and local governments to lower their cost of borrowing as rates are low and be opportunistic. And that's been taken away. So there is a tremendous amount of aggravation and consternation that was taken away. And hopefully that too.
So just we give back. Just so I understand, it's very hard now for an issuer of tax exempt debt to refinance that using this advanced refunding mechanism. With tax exempt debt, which is one reason why there's been so much demand for taxable municipal debt. Is that right?
That's right. You can't advance refund it. So said differently, if you wanted to, it's very technical, but the bottom line is that if you wanted to refund 30-year debt with the current market rates, you have to wait until the call date in order to do that. And it's
We're almost out of time. So I have a proposal. I wonder if I could ask each of the three panelists, and if we have time, Iron and Louise, tell me one thing, either one lesson we've learned in the last year or so, or one big question you really like the answer to. Can I start with you, Rachel? One big thing we've learned or one big question you'd like answered?
I would say, not to be on a dead horse here, but I mean, it is nice to get a little bit more certainty and visibility into the, amount of aid coming in, how it's going to be structured, so that we can do some long-term planning and make smart investments using those taxpayer dollars over time. When we heard, the additional aid was coming over last summer and it never came, in the fall and the winter and it never came. And then, finally December we got it. And while we're enormously grateful to get it, it creates a lot of uncertainty in the interim. And I think, we all want to make the best decisions we can with those scarce taxpayer dollars. So a little bit more, certainty and visibility into that would be greatly helpful for us.
Pat, how about you? A big lesson or a big question?
Sure. So, I think the big lesson we've learned is that the importance of our essential workforce. People that, I think, prior to COVID, we didn't give a lot of thought to these job functions, whether it's grocery stores or pharmacies or what have you. But we've learned the importance of the essential worker. And I think the big question is, what is the new normal going to be after COVID in terms of, work patterns? And I think that's, those are my two thoughts on your question, David. Thank you.
Gary?
The quality of disclosure and bond offerings matter. We've seen pricing differentials with similarly rated credits based on the ability of those government issuers actually being transparent about their fiscal health. It's not the objective metrics that matter, it's your ability to respond to these sort of cataclysmic events.
Interesting. Louise and Byron, do you want to kick in some closing questions or lessons? Byron?
For me, I've already mentioned this, but the single biggest question is what are the cost pressures from COVID, both in terms of contemporaneously to try to close the circle on the current budget pressure, but also what the future costs will be in terms of remedial education, some of the investments that may need to be made to make schools durably safe and so forth. For me, by far, that's the missing piece of the picture and what I would like to learn.
And I'll have a lesson that's not directly at state and local, but it sort of touched on it, which is that we need to do a much better job with our unemployment insurance system than what we did this time which was radical. It shouldn't be radical. It had huge benefits for the people who received it, for the macro economy, and even for state and local revenues. And so I think that's a big missing piece of our social insurance system that we should be fixing.
Right. Okay. Well, that I want to thank Rachel, Pat, and Gary for joining us, and Byron as well. As I said, we'll be posting this video on the slides on our website, and I invite you all to join us in July for our annual Municipal Finance Conference, which this year we're going to spread over 3 days, shorter sessions, as has become the Zoom habit. And we have a call for papers out, so if you have papers, rigorous papers on any aspect of the municipal capital markets or state and local fiscal issues more generally, please send them along. We'd be happy to look at them. And thanks to Stephanie and my colleague, Hao-En Chen, for helping us organize this thing so smoothly. And particularly Stephanie for having the presence of mind to get Rachel's slides in advance, which saved us from that. So again, thank you all. Be safe and have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.